From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Garrison Keillor. He's been the host of Public Radio's A Prairie Home Companion for nearly three decades. His new novel, Love Me, is about a writer from Minnesota who moves to Manhattan to write for The New Yorker and is hit with a bad case of writer's block. Then we'll talk with Jhumpa Lahiri. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her first book, Interpreter of Maladies. Her second book has just been published. It's a novel about two generations in one family, the parents who emigrate to Massachusetts from Calcutta and their American-born son. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new live double album from the Dave Holland Quintet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. French and German leaders say the Bush administration's draft UN resolution on Iraq doesn't offer the UN enough authority or move quickly enough to give Iraqis responsibility for their own government. Secretary of State Colin Powell says he welcomes input from all the Security Council members.
I think the resolution is drafted in a way that deals with the concerns that leaders such as President Chirac and Chancellor Schroeder have raised in the past. And if they have suggestions, we'd be more than happy to listen to their suggestions.
The U.S. draft resolution aims to get U.N. support for more countries to contribute troops and money to the occupation of Iraq. Some countries, such as India and Turkey, have been reluctant to send troops to Iraq without a U.N. mandate. A controversial Bush administration nominee to the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., has withdrawn his name from consideration. Miguel Estrada had been waiting for Senate confirmation for 2 years. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Democrats have blocked a vote on Estrada for months, insisting that the Bush administration release memos the nominee wrote when he served in the Justice Department. The administration refused and sought to force a vote on the Senate floor seven times. Each time, though, the GOP fell short of the 60 votes needed to cut off a Democratic filibuster. The 41-year-old Estrada, a Honduran immigrant, was the first Hispanic nominee to the important D.C. Court of Appeals, and Republicans have used the Democrats' filibuster on the nomination against them in ads aired in Hispanic areas. In a letter written to President Bush, Estrada said he was withdrawing because, quote, "the time has come to return my full attention to the practice of law and to regain the ability to make long-term plans for my family." Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The nine Democratic presidential hopefuls gather in Albuquerque, New Mexico tonight for one of several party-sanctioned debates. Tom Trowbridge reports from member station KUNM.
Tonight's debate on the University of New Mexico campus is expected to focus on issues of importance to Hispanic Americans. New Mexico and neighboring Arizona are two of the nation's most heavily Hispanic states, and both are holding presidential contests on February 3rd, a date being dubbed Hispanic Tuesday. New Mexico Democratic Party Chair Joni Gutierrez expects the debate will provide the public with more insight into the candidates.
I think you'll really get to tell the difference in their personalities and how they react to the Hispanic perspective.
New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus are co-hosting the debate that many pundits expect will focus on former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, considered the frontrunner in the race. For NPR News, I'm Tom Trowbridge in Albuquerque.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 19 points to close at 95.88. The Nasdaq was up 16 to 18.69. This is NPR News. Federal health officials say they've now found evidence of West Nile virus in mosquitoes in 32 states. The report said there were 414 human cases of the mosquito-borne illness reported in the past week, with 16 deaths. For the year so far, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there have been 18 cases of the virus, or 418 cases of the virus, with 37 fatalities. Mortgage interest rates have risen to the highest level since last summer. The increase has slowed mortgage refinancing, but also led to a boom in housing sales. NPR's Elaine Corey reports.
Nationwide, the average rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage climbed to 6.44% in the latest weekly survey by the mortgage corporation Freddie Mac. Rates haven't been that high since July 2002. The cost of a 15-year mortgage also jumped to 5.77%. With each uptick, the refinancing boom slows, but more first-time buyers jump into the housing market, sensing that mortgages will only become more expensive in the near future. Mortgage rates tend to rise and fall according to the yield on 10-year Treasury bonds, and bond yields have been climbing based on growing optimism that interest rates will remain low even as the economy rebounds. Elaine Corey, NPR News.
Federal health officials say about 8.6 million Americans have chronic diseases related to smoking, including bronchitis, emphysema, and lung cancer. The report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that chronic smoking-related diseases afflict about 10% of current and former smokers nationwide. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 13, starring Holly Hunter and Evan Rachel Wood, co-written by a 13-year-old based on her own experience, now playing select theaters.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Garrison Keillor has a new novel called Love Me, and it's his first book of fiction since 1993 that isn't set in Lake Wobegon. Love Me is about a writer from Minnesota who has always dreamed of writing for The New Yorker. After his first novel becomes a surprise bestseller, he leaves Minnesota and his wife, moves to a Manhattan apartment, and fulfills his dream of writing for the magazine. But his second novel flops, he faces a colossal writer's block, and ends up writing a newspaper advice column. Garrison Keillor is, of course, the creator and host of public radio's A Prairie Home Companion, which often has sketches and monologues set in his fictional prairie town of Lake Wobegon. Several of his books have been bestsellers. He's also written for The New Yorker and The Atlantic. And he used to write an advice column for the online magazine Salon under the name Mr. Blue, the same pen name his character uses. Let's start with a reading from Love Me. In this chapter, the writer, Larry Weiler, has just moved to Manhattan and is beginning his first day at The New Yorker.
25 West 43rd Street, an address emblazoned in the brain of every ambitious young English major in America. We wrote the address on an envelope in big, neat block letters on the odd chance that the editors might pay attention to neat handwriting, and carefully folded our neatly typed manuscript of Hollyhocks and sealed it and put it in the mailbox that we believed was the lucky mailbox for that day, maybe the downtown one, maybe the one on the corner by the school where children danced around waiting for their bus, and went home and daydreamed about the new life that would be ours when The New Yorker put its large hand on our little head and said, "You, my son, are worthy. Enter into the gates of literature. One, untold wealth. Two, admiration of women. Three, opportunities to travel. Four, personal friendships with other writers. Five, discounts on trips, automobiles, jewelry." What we did not enclose with the story was our cover letter. We debated whether to, and then nixed it. To the editors, "I suffer from chronic pain syndrome and can't eat and am all skin and bones, and the lone bright spot in my life is when I sit down with a tablet and ballpoint pen and write my stories. I enclose one that I worked on for almost 3 years. If you publish it, I will be the happiest boy in the USA. If you reject it, I will kill myself, maybe in the oven or else in the car with the engine running and the tailpipe plugged. In my pocket will be your rejection slip. Think about it, Larry Weiler."
That's Garrison Keillor reading from his new novel, Love Me. Garrison, when did you start reading The New Yorker, and what did it first mean to you?
I was 13 years old. My junior high school English teacher, Frayne Anderson, lent me a copy. I'd never seen it before in my life. I sat and pored over it, and to me it was the most elegant thing I'd ever seen.
Is there anything about the style of writing that was different from anything you had ever seen before?
Well, looking back, I wonder if I didn't sort of conflate the writing with the advertisements, with the little notices up front for the jazz clubs where Blossom Deary was playing, you know, somewhere in the East Side. It just all kind of worked in together, the cartoons and everything. But I but I But I loved A.J. Liebling. To me, he stood out from the rest of them as somebody who could not possibly be from Minnesota. He was a true New Yorker to me. I didn't read The New Yorker in order to read memoirs about somebody's childhood on the Great Plains. I read it to find out about the big city itself, and he was a big city writer.
Well, that's the thing. When you started to strive to be published in The New Yorker, did you feel like you had to change your voice and become somebody who you weren't?
You know, if I'd been smarter, I would have done it. I mean, if I had thought that was the key, but I have no, I had no idea what my voice was, so I just wrote every sort of thing and packed it into envelopes and sent it east, and they bought a story of mine back in 1969. They just bought it off the slush pile. It was almost a historic event at the magazine when this happened. After I went there and got an office there, people recalled this to me.
And
it happened so seldom.
What was that story?
It was a story called Local Family Makes Son Happy. And it was a tiny story. It probably was less than 250, no, about 300 words. And it was a story about a family who are worried about their teenage son and worried that he may be killed in a car crash. And so to keep him home and give him what all boys want, they hire a prostitute for him. And it all works out really well, and she cooks and everything. And the story ended up with a recipe for fancy eggs.
So what kind of letter did you get back from The New Yorker when they decided to publish this?
A brief letter on their creamy stationery from Roger Angel, which I read sitting on the front steps of my house about 85 times and then never showed to anybody.
What did it say?
Roger Angel, who's still at The New Yorker, who's 81 years old, was a great letter writer, a great writer of encouraging letters to young writers. And so he began it with a paragraph, I'm sure, of fulsome praise about this wonderful piece I had written, and then a little paragraph about the other pieces that he had decided not to accept. And, you know, probably we're all wrong about this, but somehow they just seemed, you know, not to be quite right, not to be you at your best, and so forth. He was so great at turning down things and accepting things. And after you read a letter from Roger Angel, you really walked on air for probably 15 or 20 minutes.
In 1966, and this was, I think, before your article was accepted by The New Yorker, you went to, I think, The Atlantic, maybe The New Yorker, several other magazines and publishing houses, looking for work. Were you confident of yourself, or did you feel like you had to create a new personality for yourself as you were presenting yourself to all these important places?
Well, I thought I had constructed a pretty good personality for myself. But, of course, when you take the bus all the way out to New York, as I did, and you are living down on West 19th Street in what was then a pretty rough neighborhood in Chelsea, and you're hiking and taking the subway up to Midtown, and you spend a lot of time sitting, waiting in lobbies, your carefully constructed persona starts to crack at the edges, and you really start to seem kind of needy and pitiful, I think. But nonetheless, they all did me the great favor of turning me down, which, as you look back, was, you know, the best thing that could have happened to you. Instead of getting a job as you were hoping as a researcher at Sports Illustrated, and to go to work in the hive of Time Inc. and spend the next 30 years. You know, filing clippings. Instead, you were released out into the world to be a writer, which which was exactly the right thing, except you weren't smart enough to know it at the time.
Your character moves to New York after he makes a lot of money with his first book, but his wife doesn't want to go, so he goes alone. And his description of what the New Yorker is like sounds like it's based on your fantasies from when you were growing up in Minnesota, imagining what life in the New Yorker might have been like. So would you read us his description of life at the New Yorker on page 76?
You thought this sounded like fiction? You thought this, this didn't ring true to you? Let me read it to you and see if you don't change your mind about this.
Yeah. Man.
The magazine was a club like the U.S. Senate. And once you got in, you hobnobbed with everybody. There was no hi-hatting, no stiff-arming the junior members, only a pleasant pool of amiability. E.B. White took me birdwatching, and E.M. Frimbo took me on the Bangor Night Mail, and Pauline Kael took me to movies. She always brought her own popcorn because theaters didn't use real butter. I played ping-pong with S.J. Perlman. He said, "Stand up there and I'll whip the bejiggers out of you, you sullen peasant." The S.J. stands for San Juan, baby. You familiar with the word muerte? And after he whipped me, he adjusted his chapeau and loped away natty, cool, keen as a wolfhound, off to lunch with some lissom starlet and lure her back to his pied-à-terre at the San Moritz. J.F. Powers took me to his barber Joe around the corner from St. Ignatius. Salinger gave me his memoirs, a cardboard carton that weighed about 30 pounds. Sean dropped in. He was short, muscular, bald, with big hands. He said, "You sail?" I said, "I have." He said, "You're on."
So, Garrison, compare that to what you actually found at the New Yorker.
You expect me to tell you what I actually found? The years of neglect and suffering and misery, sitting in an anteroom, trying to wait to get in to see people? No. No, there was some truth to that. The New Yorker was a very congenial place. Some people were more congenial than others, but Joe Mitchell was a very nice guy. He loved to go to lunch, and he loved to regale people with stories about his pal, A.J. Liebling. And Brendan Gill was just the soul of amiability. There was no hi-hatting on Brendan's part, and a lot of other people as well. It was the young, ambitious people who were cold and didn't have any time for him.
I'm wondering what it was like for you to be edited at The New Yorker. Your character is told by the editor, William Shawn, that his writing is fussy and girlish. I don't imagine you were told that.
What was it like to be edited by Mr. Shawn? He was a very careful editor. And the legend about William Shawn, which was absolute truth, was that he read and made his mark on everything that went into the magazine. Your editor, my editor, Roger Angel, read it, of course, and made his suggestions, and the copy editor made anonymous suggestions, and the grammarian, Eleanor Gould, made her suggestions in the margin, and then there were small, very neat suggestions for a change of word here, possibly adding a comma there, perhaps ridding one of this comma, and each one with the initials WS in a little box. It was really quite amazing to be edited by him. You accepted maybe a half, maybe a third of his suggestions and felt grateful for those, and there was no problem in turning down the ones you turned down. He was a great, great editor, and how he ever did all of that work and still lead a life, I have no idea.
Did you stop writing for The New Yorker when the editor changed?
I packed up my office and moved all the books out one day when I heard that Tina Brown had been appointed the new editor of The New Yorker. It took me about 5 minutes to think about this, and I simply did it. There was a new regime coming in, and it wasn't one that I was sympathetic to, and I thought there are other things to do in life.
My guest is Garrison Keillor. His new novel is called Love Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Garrison Keillor is my guest, and his new book is a novel called Love Me, about a writer who, after he has a hugely successful bestseller, ends up writing for The New Yorker and then facing writer's block. Now your character starts writing an advice column for a Minneapolis paper, and it's the only thing he can write. He's totally blocked when it comes to his fiction, but he can write this advice column. Yeah. And you actually wrote a column for Salon that has the same, under the same pen name that your character uses, Mr. Blue. And, you know, I liked your advice column in Salon, and I thought
so. Oh?
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
Here's an advice you gave one woman. I wrote this down, yes, so I could read it to you. And this is a woman who's feeling guilty about her 3-month affair, which she hasn't told her husband about. And you say to her that she might be in need of some simple narrative therapy. You say, see a psychologist and tell the whole story. It can ease your spirit to hear it come out of your own mouth and bounce off the walls and not be resonating and resonating in your head. And reading that, I thought, well, you know, that's interesting that you see therapy as being narrative therapy, about telling your story. And what do you think is helpful about that?
Well, I've never been in therapy, so I don't know. I'm surmising that the reason you pay that other person to sit there in the dim light with the legal pad on their lap is so that you tell your story. And that's the reason for the sort of open-ended questioning of therapists. I only know about this from, you know, reading Woody Allen and from New Yorker cartoons, but this is what I surmise. You surely don't expect this person to say wise things to you or to lead you towards some wisdom that is not already there in your head. So you must be there so that you can tell your story. And once you get it outside of yourself, then you are better able to see it. And perhaps you are better able to see how ordinary it is. In the mists of your own imagination seemed to be a very dramatic, very profoundly disturbing story. When it comes out of your mouth and hangs there in the air, it's really kind of every day.
When you were asked to write an advice column for Salon, did you think, oh, this is another thing I'm being asked to do because I'm a celebrity and I get asked to do all kinds of things that, you know, aren't really designed for me?
They wanted me to write a column about politics. I thought, that is way too much work. And I don't know enough. I don't know anything. And I don't want to write about politics. So I suggested that I write an advice column. They were a little uncertain about that. But I felt there was a real niche here, and I still do. Advice columns tend to be written by women, and I think that women need to hear a man talk about these very same romantic situations and family problems and how do I find somebody to be in love with? I'm 48 years old, and I have a good job, and I own my own home, and I have a lot of friends, and my friends say I'm fun to be with, and I'm fairly good-looking, and why can't I find somebody who will love me and let me love them? I think a man's point of view should be heard on these things, particularly by women.
I'm guessing here, but I'm guessing that in your private life you weren't known as the person that everybody goes to for advice about their messy emotional lives. What made you think that you could actually do this?
People don't come to me in real life and ask because I am a writer, and they don't trust writers. They know that writers have no scruples when it comes to good material. And they could pour out their little heart to me, and 2 weeks later on a Saturday, they would hear the essence of their story done up in a Guy Noir episode. So that's why people don't in real life. But I felt that I could do this, and I found it to be a great column to do.
One last question: is doing Prairie Home Companion still fun for you? If it ever was fun in that sense, it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of fun. It's a very sociable show to do, and we have a very capable crew, I find it very congenial to be around them, the technical people and the backstage people and so forth. And I like that. But I'm looking forward to this next season, and I am in the process of trying to put together something I've never had before, and that is a cast of writers, and to have a bunch of writers around who will work on this. Comedy belongs in large part, I think, to young people, and I am looking at people who are in their early and mid 20s, and I've found some wonderful people, and so I'm looking forward to that, and moving into a gray eminence stage of life, and having these people do the heavy lifting. So
they'd be writing sketches or writing your monologues too?
Oh, they'll write sketches. I want them to write sketches. I want to make a half-hour radio drama series out of Guy Noir, Private Eye, so he can go off on his own and solve crimes among the well-to-do, and then create a new series of sketches on the show and just keep on working in behalf of Bebop, Rebop, Rhubarb Pie and the Ketchup Advisory Board and the American Duct Tape Council and all of our other generous sponsors.
All right, that sounds great. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Garrison Keillor's new novel is called Love Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com, and from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After winning a Pulitzer Prize for her first book, Jhumpa Lahiri has written a new novel called The Namesake about a couple who has emigrated to the U.S. from Calcutta and their American-born son. We'll talk with Lahiri about the book and about her own experiences as the daughter of immigrants. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the Dave Holland Quintet.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jhumpa Lahiri, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2000 for her first book, the collection of short stories Interpreter of Maladies. Her first novel, The Namesake, has just been published, and like her short stories, it's about the lives of immigrants and their children. A young couple, Ashma and Ashok Ganguly, has emigrated from Calcutta to Massachusetts, where they have a son whom they name Gogol. In a New York Times book review of The Namesake, critic Michiko Kakutani wrote, "It is a novel about two generations of the Ganguly family, and at the same time, it is a novel about exile and its discontents, a novel that is as affecting in its Chekhovian exploration of fathers and sons, parents and children, as it is resonant in its exploration of what is acquired and lost by immigrants and their children in pursuit of the American dream." Jhumpa Lahiri is the daughter of immigrants from Calcutta. She was born in London in 1967 and grew up in Rhode Island. She now lives in Brooklyn. Let's start with a reading from The Namesake from the first chapter, which is set in 1968, a year and a half after Ashma Ganguly has moved to America. She's in the hospital, about to give birth to her son.
Dr. Ashley pokes in his head from time to time. "No need to worry," he chirps, putting a stethoscope to Ashima's belly, patting her hand, admiring her various bracelets. "Everything is looking perfectly normal. We are expecting a perfectly normal delivery, Mrs. Ganguly." But nothing feels normal to Ashima. For the past 18 months, ever since she's arrived in Cambridge, nothing has felt normal at all. It's not so much the pain, which she knows, somehow, she will survive. It's the consequence, motherhood in a foreign land. For it was one thing to be pregnant, to suffer the queasy mornings in bed, the sleepless nights, the dull throbbing in her back, the countless visits to the bathroom. Throughout the experience, in spite of her growing discomfort, she'd been astonished by her body's ability to make life, exactly as her mother and grandmother and all her great-grandmothers had done. That it was happening so far from home, unmonitored and unobserved by those she loved, had made it more miraculous still. But she is terrified to raise a child in a country where she is related to no one, where she knows so little, where life seems so tentative and spare.
That's Jhumpa Lahiri reading from her new novel, The Namesake. I want to ask you about a phrase in there. She's worried about having this baby unmonitored and unobserved by those she loved. And I'm wondering what made you think of being unobserved by those she loved.
Well, I think I was just thinking about, you know, when we go through traumatic, dramatic changes in life, be they good or bad, to have to be isolated while those things are happening, I think makes them somehow unreal in a way. And so I think that what Ashima is feeling here is that she needs to be acknowledged, her life, her pregnancy, all of this needs to be acknowledged somehow by people she really knows and trusts rather than the people in America whom she doesn't know and doesn't trust.
It's as if it needs to be witnessed by the people she really loves,
exactly.
The people she really connects to, and they're not there to witness this. So,
yes, and
it's
I
not
think that,
it's not a full experience.
Yes, exactly.
Names are very important in your book, and one of the main characters is the son of a couple who was from India. And the son is named Gogol. He doesn't really understand why he has that name. All he knows is it's really weird and kind of embarrassing, like when he's in school and they start reading Gogol, and his name is Gogol. He's not really proud of it. He's just kind of confused and kind of embarrassed. Gogol was his pet name. There was a tradition in this family that the grandmother would name all the children, but the grandmother is far away, and a letter with the name never arrives. But the parents have given the son a pet name. What is the pet name in the Bengali tradition?
The pet name is essentially the name that is used at home and by family and by friends and by people who with whom you're very close, but really stemming from the family. The pet name is what your parents call you, what your grandparents call you, what your siblings would call you, your older siblings. If they're younger, they don't call you by name because there's a separate tradition of having to address your elders by specific terms and never by name.
And it's only for people who know you really well. Other people probably don't even know what that name is.
Yes. And what happens, what usually ends up happening, what I've observed, what usually ends up happening is that as soon as the child goes to school, he or she is enrolled under the formal name, the proper name, the good name. And as a result, you can have very close friends, you know, made after the age of, say, 5 or 6, who will call you by your good name. And many times I've observed that, you know, I may have, you know, aunts and uncles who met each other in, say, college or high school and subsequently got married, and they will call each other by their good name. So really the pet name at its heart is a reference to childhood, to those very earliest years of your life when you are in the fold of, very firmly within the fold of a family and taken care of and all of those things that are implicit in being very young and not having an independence and identity, a separate identity from your family.
Could you tell us what your pet name was?
My pet name is Jhumpa, and my good name never took hold. I actually have two other names that were supposed to be one of them was supposed to end up being my public name, my name in the world. But what happened in real life is sort of similar to what happens to my character, Gogol, which is that when I was enrolled in school, I think it was kindergarten, and my parents took me to school and said, here's our daughter, her name is Nilanjana, which is the first of my good names on my birth certificate and on my passport. And the teacher must have looked a bit overwhelmed by the name and I think asked something along the lines of, do you have anything shorter? And my parents said, well, we also call her Jhumpa. And she decided that was the better option. And I don't think my parents realized at the time that this would really stick so firmly and that my good name never really had a chance. And so as a result, I've been Jhumpa in public and in private all my life. And it's been remarked upon by many of my Indian relatives that this is somehow inappropriate. And many people, after I published my book, you know, many people sort of said, you know, why are you published under that name? That's not the name you're supposed to publish books under. You know, that's just a pet name. So it's very funny to me.
The son in your novel, Gogol, is given that name because his father was reading a book by Gogol when his father was saved from a train wreck. And it was, in fact, a page from the book that was seen by the rescuers. And if he hadn't been reading that book, the rescuers wouldn't have known he was there and wouldn't have been able to save his life. But Gogol doesn't know that. Why wouldn't the father tell Gogol the story behind his name?
I think the reason the father withholds that information about how he was rescued from this train wreck may have something to do with the fact that once the father goes to America, he wants to put that accident, the memory of that night, behind him in a way, and doesn't really want to, I don't know, I imagine that he sort of compartmentalized his life in terms of before the accident and after the accident. And I think geographically that, you know, manifests itself as life in India versus life in the United States. I think also it probably has to do with a more general kind of estrangement that the father feels toward his son in terms of how different they are, how different their life experiences have been and will be, and just a sort of distance that exists between them emotionally.
Is this something that you feel a lot of children of immigrants have faced, that there are defining experiences that their parents have had, that their parents feel are like from another world or another part of their life or somehow kind of inexplicable and untranslatable for their children, and therefore it increases the gap. It increases the cultural divide because these key things aren't translated for the children.
I think so. I think you put that very, very well. I think there's a sense that once you're in the new world, you're just working so hard to survive in the present and move toward the future in a way that there isn't even energy or time to dwell on that past in a way. And I think for me, at least, observing my parents, I just saw them in the moment. I just saw them as foreigners living in New England, struggling, having accents, you know, being bewildered by things. And their lives in India were so remote, and there was so little for them to connect with, you know, in terms of their past. You know, that it was just these letters, half of which got lost in the mail, and, you know, the occasional phone call and the occasional visit. And, you know, I think the world has really changed so much in the time that I've been alive. I think it is different for immigrants now in many ways. I mean, the world has sort of grown smaller, and communication is so much more available in so many different ways and improved. But I felt, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s, I really felt that my parents, I felt that India was just another planet. It was just another world.
Could you speak their language, or were you only able to communicate with them in English?
No, Bengali was my first language, literally. I didn't speak any English until I went to school, and so I always knew how to speak with them in Bengali, and I continue to speak with them in Bengali.
My guest is Jhumpa Lahiri. Her new novel is called The Namesake. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jhumpa Lahiri. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her first book, which is a collection of short stories called Interpreter of Maladies. Her new book is a novel called The Namesake. You grew up thinking of your parents as the foreigners, the people struggling with English, the people who didn't understand American customs. What was it like for you when you went with them to India and saw them in their own culture, knowing that you were the foreigner there?
Well, I both was and wasn't the foreigner, which made it interesting. I had been raised in another part of the world and knew things that, for example, my relatives in India didn't know. But on the other hand, I did feel a sense of belonging that I didn't feel in the United States. But it was all very, you know, It was very mixed. It was never one thing. And similarly, I think over the years, I saw my parents returning to a place where they ostensibly belonged, where they had family, where they had, you know, all of these memories and connections and a sense of place. But over the years, I felt that all of those things were attenuated, and that they too felt like foreigners. And So I never saw anything as being one, strictly one thing or the other. And I think that going there taught me a lot about, you know, the position of a person who leaves one's native country. My parents always put it as they always feel like they have a foot in two separate boats on the water, and each of the boats is floating and wanting to sort of go in its own direction, and you're sort of stuck in between, not knowing which to go into.
In your book, the son, Gogol, never sees his parents display any physical affection. What was your understanding of love and marriage from watching your parents?
My parents had an arranged marriage, and so I was aware that this tradition existed in the world. Most of their relatives have had similarly arranged marriages. And I felt a combination, I think, growing up. I felt a combination of both bewilderment that, you know, two strangers could suddenly find themselves married as a result of an afternoon's meeting or decision by their parents or what have you. But I also felt very protective of them because I felt that, you know, that their marriage and also, you know, all of these other marriages that I knew of was regarded with, you know, as a sort of bizarre, primitive tradition that was backward somehow in the eyes of, say, my American friends or, you know, acquaintances in school, you know. So I really felt both things. Even as a young child, I was always hesitant to, you know, accept one way and reject the other way.
Yeah, your first book, a collection of short stories called Interpreter of Maladies, won a Pulitzer Prize. Did winning a big prize like this for your first book make it any easier or more difficult to write your second book?
It certainly didn't make it easier because nothing makes writing easy for me. I can't imagine anything that could make it easy. I wish there were something, but unfortunately, I don't think that thing exists. I think that, you know, what I've tried to do is really sort of associate that all of the attention that was brought to me because of the Pulitzer, I sort of associated it very firmly with Interpreter of Maladies. And by the time I had won the prize, I was already working on The Namesake, and Interpreter of Maladies was very much a part of my past. And I just sort of thought, well, this is one prize that belongs to one book that I'm going to write. And, you know, my goal is to write, you know, to create a body of work and to keep writing books. And, you know, some will win prizes, I guess. One of them has won a prize. I don't assume they all will.
Do you consider writing to be very difficult?
Extremely difficult, yes.
Do you enjoy it? I realize enjoy when you're talking about work isn't enjoy like when you're talking about sitting at the beach, but I mean, mm-hmm. I guess...
I enjoy the challenge, yes. I enjoy the challenge of it. But I don't, you know, it's not sitting at the beach. I don't have a good time while I'm working at it. It's very difficult just in a basic way, just in terms of writing the sentences and being satisfied with them on any level is very hard. And it's also hard to, you know, the sort of psychological aspect of it, the thinking about things, imagining things, confronting your fears, your pain in your life and the lives of other people. That's also very difficult for me.
So this kind of comes down to why do it? Why why write? What compels you to do it?
It's not really a choice for me. I never thought that way about writing. I never thought to myself, people sometimes say, when did you decide you wanted to be a writer? There was no moment of decision. I started writing as soon as I could start to read. It just felt like, it's like someone asking me, why do you read? You know, I read to understand life. I write to understand life. You know, I can't explain it in any other way. I only know that if I don't write, I don't feel like I'm living fully and that I'm not understanding life as best as I can. And I also feel, I just don't feel right. I feel quite miserable, actually, if I'm not at least trying to write. So that's why I do it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Jhumpa Lahiri's new novel is called The Namesake. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the Dave Holland Quintet. This is Fresh Air. Bass player Dave Holland founded a quintet in 1997 that has become something of a jazz phenomenon, acclaimed by many writers as the best working group in the music and topping numerous jazz polls. The quintet has just released a live album. Our own critic, Kevin Whitehead, weighs in.
Dave Holland's tune, Prime Directive. Right away, you can hear reasons Holland's quintet is a critical hit. The simultaneous horn solos, the way the band sneaks up on a catchy theme, and the propulsive rhythm that kicks everyone along. Still, it's curious a group so many folks call the best in jazz so seldom plays straight dang, 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 swing time. Drummer Billy Kilson spends so little time splashing on his ride cymbal, he sounds more like a funk than a jazz drummer. On the quintet's new double CD for ECM, Extended Play, Live at Birdland, even the swingingest bits may be wrenched out of context or squeezed into an unfamiliar one. Trombonist Robin Eubanks' tune Metamorphose starts out in tricky 10-8 time and then gets really complicated. Here, swing is just one rhythmic option among many. I bet they rehearse that a lot. But then precision is Dave Holland's hallmark. He plays the bass fiddle in tune, with clear articulation and on top of the beat phrasing that made him an instant hit when he arrived in New York from England in the 60s. As leader, Holland likes riffs or vamps that pile up in layers, interlocking parts conceptually derived from minimalism or third world percussion choirs. That influence is underscored when vibraphonist Steve Nelson plays the wood marimba. Juggler's Parade also recalls composer Anthony Davis's music, inspired by Indonesian gamelans. In a way, this whole band is about rhythm, and the group concept is so clear, trombonist Eubanks and saxophonist Chris Potter can write for it in what sounds like Holland's voice. Both horn players sound especially good here, phrasing as incisively as the rhythm section. This is Chris Potter. I've admired Dave Holland for as long as I've listened to jazz, but I'm not as gaga over his quintet as some colleagues are. There are ingenious structures and fine performances on extended play, and the band sounds more fiery live than in the studio. But to me, it sounds a bit claustrophobic and predetermined, despite the freewheeling solos and improvised breaks. In Dave Holland's quintet, everything runs like clockwork, which is its strength and limitation.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed the new live album by the Dave Holland Quintet. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback by Thomas L. Friedman, Longitudes and Attitudes, The World in the Age of Terrorism. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Jeffrey Eugenides. His latest novel, Middlesex, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. It's just been published in paperback. He's also the author of The Virgin Suicides, which was adapted into the film of the same name. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.